The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article is from Wholeness in the Lifestyle section of Oprah Magazine. 5 Ways to Get Your Focus Back. Attention frackers are everywhere. Here's how to retrain your brain to concentrate. And this article is by Louisa Camps, with a K. Ah, focus. It used to feel so delicious, sitting at my desk, warming my head under a gooseneck lamp as I drilled into work, ideas clicking in a cone of pure concentration. Lately, though, my capacity to pay deep, prolonged attention has taken a licking. The everything everywhere all at once wallop of the pandemic dimmed my mental wattage. Then, wired and fried from that crisis, my once passable ability to resist constantly checking my phone for texts, emails, and social feed updates crumbled completely. I know I'm preaching to the choir here. Many of us spend unholy amounts of time beguiled and stupefied by the Internet. Over the past 20 years, Gloria Mark, Ph.D., a professor of informatics at the University of California, Irvine, has found that the length of time people can focus on a single screen has dropped, on average, from 2.5 minutes to 47 seconds. Even worse, we're no longer just putty in the hands of the tech lords who've hijacked our attention. We're so accustomed to being disrupted by our devices that when the number of pings goes down, we check screens more often, just to keep the same rhythm of interruptions going, as Mark, author of Attention Span, recently told the New York Times. But there's a flip side to learning what our tech addiction is doing to our brains. A growing understanding that attention is a precious resource we can recultivate. Think about anything you've achieved in your life that you're proud of, whether it's starting a business, being a good parent, or learning to play the guitar. That thing required a huge amount of sustained focus, says Joanne Harry, H-A-R-I, author of Stolen Focus. When your ability to achieve your goals deteriorates, you feel worse about yourself. But when you get your attention back, it's like regaining your superpower. Here are a few proven ways to do it. Respect your internal clock. One of the simplest ways to improve attention is to get enough sleep every night. Most adults need at least 7 hours. The ability to focus on what we need to do to accomplish our goals is largely guided by the prefrontal cortex, a.k.a. the executive center of our brains, says Charan Ranganath. That's C-H-A-R-A-N. The second name is spelled R-A-N-G-A-N-A-T-H. Ph.D., a professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of California, Davis. Our brains can pay close attention only to one thing at a time. So when we multitask, toggling between ordering new sneakers, drafting an email, and half listening to a conference call, say we incur switching costs that quickly deplete our limited supply of cognitive energy. Multitasking also impairs our ability to remember new information and makes us more error-prone. Effects that are amplified when we're sleep-deprived, says Ranganath, author of Why We Remember. Not getting enough sleep is very bad for the prefrontal cortex, he says. If we don't have the mental resources to say, this is my goal, and here's what I'm going to focus on, we'll only remember whatever grabs our attention. The key is to aim for consistency, says time management expert Laura Vanderkam, author of Tranquility by Tuesday. Her advice is to give yourself a grown-up bedtime and stick to it. This makes evenings more purposeful and peaceful, especially if you douse your screens at least an hour before bed, and greatly increases your odds of waking up feeling refreshed and optimistic. Set explicit goals. A study published last year in the journal Attention, Perception, and Psychophysics found that people who were given progressively quicker time-limited goals for completing tasks versus those who were just asked to respond as quickly as possible not only decreased their reaction times, but also showed fewer lapses in attention than the control group. Vanderkamp recommends regular weekly planning sessions to identify your most important goals for the coming week and scheduling blocks of uninterrupted time to tackle them, ideally when you're most productive. Late morning and mid-afternoon are peak focus times for most people. It's also helpful, she says, to batch up piddling tasks, ones you can knock off when your brain is at half-mast, and schedule windows for those, too. When you think through the upcoming week and what's most important to you, then figure out roughly when you intend to do those tasks and solve any logistical challenges. It's easier to do what you said you would versus losing hours to TikTok on a Tuesday afternoon, she says. Name your saboteurs. Metacognition, the ability to think about our thinking, is one of our great human strengths. And while he was writing his new book, Ranganath took advantage of it, actually practicing what I preach by pausing for 30 seconds to consider why he was growing distracted when he noticed his attention was waning. Often, pausing helped him realize that he was thirsty, hungry, or sleepy, and just needed a 5-minute break to get a drink or a snack, or listen to an energizing song, or to scratch an itch to check out quickly a colleague's Threads feed. But other times, pausing helped Ranganath realize that he needed a longer break because he was truly exhausted or needed a few hours to digest new research. Overall, he says, learning to pause and consider what was distracting him was ultimately a huge time and focus saver. Being on a treadmill of constantly trying to do one thing after another is harmful and ultimately makes us less productive, says Ranganath. But giving yourself time to think really helps a lot. It protects you from misinformation, and it helps you remember things more accurately, he adds. 30 seconds is all it takes. Practice mind wandering. Fed up with feeling constantly wired by and to tech, Harry left his phone with a friend and spent 3 months on Provincetown with the hope of regaining his once robust ability to focus. At first, he set out on long daily walks, feeling slightly guilty as a busy journalist. He was used to ticking boxes on his to-do list even while walking. However, to his surprise, he soon realized that his phone-free walks were often the most creatively productive part of his day. Delving into the science of mind wandering, he learned that it's a crucial and underappreciated form of attention. Unlike convergent attention, the kind we use to consciously focus on a complex data set, say, mind wandering promotes looser associational or divergent thinking, which is essential for seeing connections between ideas and creative thinking. When your mind is wandering and you think without anything to focus on, you're doing important things, says Harry. You're processing the past and making sense of it. You're anticipating the future and preparing yourself for it. And you're making connections between things that otherwise would not be connected, which is part of creativity. When we cram every minute with something to grab our attention, checking phones in line at the grocery store and the like, he adds, we're really in the worst of all worlds. We're just skimming, frantically skimming. Read a damn book. Borrowing into a great book handsomely rewards our effort and attention. As Harry notes, reading also gives our minds valuable time to wander. Yes, we are focusing on words on the page, but our mind takes flight. These days, sadly, many struggle to read anything longer than a Yelp review. And that's partly because we're accustomed to reading online, where, research shows, our eyes dart in a zigzagging or F-shaped pattern, skimming and racing to get the end, says Marianne Wolfe, a professor and director of the Center for Dyslexia, Diverse Learners, and Social Justice at the University of California, Los Angeles, and author of Reader Come Home. Wolfe worries about skimming, which carries over to reading on paper once it's ingrained, because it erodes the cognitive patience people need to press through dense prose to understand a complex political argument, vital for a healthy democracy, or to imagine that the inner life of another person is not so different from our own, as reading great fiction allows us to do. For rusty, deep readers or newbies who want to try, Wolfe recommends devoting 20 minutes a day to practice reading on paper, paying attention to detail. I can't promise that this will happen to everyone, she says, but I can say that allocating your mind's best attention to looking at a word, a sentence, a paragraph, and making an analogy between what you already know and what is fresh in the text is a healthy antidote to the bombardment of stimuli we live with. It situates you and gives you a glimpse of who you are at that moment in time, Wolfe says. Now that's something to savor. Well, we have Oprah Insider next for you. Being vulnerable is a sign of strength. Oprah shares an eye-opening lesson from our latest book club selection. Hi, and happy Sunday, Oprah Daily Insiders. I hope you're spending quality time restoring yourself this weekend. Now, for me, that often involves spending time with a good book. And if you're looking for one, may I suggest my newest book club selection, The Many Lives of Mama Love by Laura Love Hardin. It's a wild ride of a memoir written by a soccer mom who was secretly addicted to heroin and ends up in jail. What impressed me most about this story was Laura's ability to take an honest look at herself. In one memorable section, she reflects on her destructive pattern when it comes to matters of the heart, writing, I loved fully until someone hurt me, and then I just pretended to love while remaining vigilant for the next bout of pain. I didn't have the skill set to work things out. I didn't know how to talk someone through or express my deepest feelings. My own emotions embarrassed me, so I kept them private. Vulnerable wasn't a look I was willing to wear. Now that's some serious self-awareness and true vulnerability. So, insiders, my intention for you this week is to try and think of a way you can embrace your own vulnerability. Maybe it's by sharing something you fear or letting someone know they've hurt you. However you decide to get in touch with your vulnerability this week, let me know. I can't wait to hear. This article is from Wellness. The Secret Superpower of OCD. How a Novelist Used Swimming Laps to Quiet Her Mind and Unlock Her Creativity. This is by Emily Barth Isler, I-S-L-E-R. On a February day in 2022, I arrived at the community pool in my Southern California neighborhood and adjusted my borrowed swim cap, a hand-me-down for my daughter, who'd worn it once when she was in second grade. I'd come with a single purpose, to attempt to swim a few laps. Honestly, I had little faith in my ability to do so. I had taken swim lessons as a child, and I knew I was competent enough not to drown, but actual lap swimming felt about as likely to me as growing wings and flying like a bird. I am not a naturally athletic person, but after relocating from New York to Los Angeles, I felt like I owed it to myself to at least live out the fantasy I'd had for years of swimming outdoors for exercise. I gave myself specific guidelines and loopholes. First, a time limit. I only had to try for 20 minutes. Next, I gave myself a mantra. My only job is to move my body from one end of the pool to the other in any way possible. I told myself I could just float or gently paddle or even walk in the shallow end. To my surprise, less than 5 minutes into the first 20-minute experiment, I was hooked. The water in the Olympic-sized pool was clear and blue and, thank goodness, lightly heated. Palm trees dotted its edges. I found I didn't need to do all that much floating or walking. I was gliding, weightless, flying. I did not, as per my fantasies, discover that I was preternaturally gifted at lap swimming or innately graceful in the water. I did not find it magically effortless. What I did discover, however, was that swimming laps gave me what years of yoga classes and scores of sporadically used meditation apps could not. Quiet. Calm. Attention to the breath and nothing else. As a neurodivergent person who has lived with obsessive-compulsive disorder my whole life, this kind of quiet was new to me. My brain is always on, always busy, full of multiple strands of music playing and thought streaming and worries and lists, all running simultaneously. I also have synesthesia, a neurological condition in which a person experiences more than one sense at a time in response to a single stimulus. For example, seeing colors when one hears music, or tasting words, which adds another layer of perpetual input. I liken my OCD to a puppy. If you get a dog and you don't train it, it makes your life miserable. It chews up your shoes and wakes you up at night and pees in your closet. But if you train the puppy, it becomes a source of unconditional love and immeasurable joy. Cuddles and walks outside and new friends. Thanks to therapy and medication, the dog training in this metaphor, I have figured out how to embrace and utilize my busy brain. I've learned how to adjust the volume in my head, or to mask it with podcasts and audiobooks when it's too much, or I don't want to be alone with my thoughts. I've even come to see it as my creative superpower as a writer, a gift. When properly channeled, the endless what-ifs and what-abouts and then-whats that race through my mind, thanks to my particular subtype of OCD, fuel the ideas that turn into my novels. But then I started swimming, and finally experienced the kind of clear, quiet mind that meditation gurus talk about. All the other stuff fell away. Swimming is different from pure meditation, of course. In the water, focusing on breathing is survival, not a choice. The timing is non-negotiable. You can't save it for later when you're underwater or ignore it. You have to develop a rhythm, or you literally can't continue. Once I got used to the quiet in my brain, something amazing happened. I found that I could let in a little bit of chosen noise in the form of inspiration. That spring, I wrote most of my second book, a middle-grade novel called The Color of Sound, while alternating between breaststrokes and backstrokes. I positioned my iPhone on one edge of the pool, and between sets of laps, I typed plot lines in my notes app and recorded dialogue via voice memos. And since the main character in that book has synesthesia, I thought she might enjoy swimming for some of the same reasons I do. I turned her grandparents' pool into a major plot point, and together, she and I explored the quieting of our busy brains, the absence of music, and the clarity of thought that comes with breathing, and only breathing, at least for a little while. Sometimes it felt like my characters lived at the pool, and I would go there to swim so I could visit them and let them tell me what happened next. Eventually, it felt like adding swimming into my plot of this book was a predestined inevitability. How could I have ever told the story without the pool, where a major plot climax eventually occurs? It now seems unfathomable. Swimming is, naturally, rife with metaphors for both life and writing. When watching someone do the basic front crawl stroke, it appears to be mostly about reaching extending ever forward. But that is only a piece of it. The actual forward motion happens because of the next part of the stroke, the displacement of water that occurs beneath the surface. Just like anything in life that looks uncomplicated or easy, there's often a world of effort, pure grind, that nobody sees. That first spring season of swimming was like falling in love. When I wasn't swimming, I was thinking about my next swim, or remembering the joy of my previous swim. I made friends at the pool, marveled at the fact that in California I could swim outside year-round beneath a blue sky. I realized soon after I started that when I lift my head to breathe every few strokes or swim backstroke, I can look up at that sky and toward a majestic cluster of palm trees. I can watch airplanes make fluffy cloud streaks above. I can gaze in awe at the way the sun casts rainbows on the floor of the pool. I've swum twice a week for 2 years now. It's not always perfect. I question my practice on days when it's 60 degrees or on the rare mornings when it rains in Southern California. But I just keep moving my body from one side of the pool to the other. I let ideas flow like the water, and I breathe. If you're interested, the book The Color of Sound by Emily Barth Eisler is available. It's $19 at Bookshop. This article comes from the Lifestyle Wholeness section. How to Become Narcissist Resistant. 4 ways to inoculate yourself against this toxic personality type. And it's written by Romani Dervasula, PhD. Healing from a relationship with a narcissist is an act of resistance, defiance, and rebellion. It isn't just about getting past a broken heart, toxic divorce, parental estrangement, or toxic boss. It's about a shift in your psychology and worldview. Healing is about spotting a gaslighter before they dismantle reality. Healing means that you see narcissistic patterns clearly and don't think that this time will be the exception. It is about giving yourself permission to say no, and not just to the narcissistic folks who already riddle your life, but to the ones you still haven't met. If you've ended a relationship with a narcissist, you might live with a looming fear. What if this happens to me again? The truth is, it will happen again. The ubiquitous nature of the narcissistic personality style and the fact that society rewards it means that you will continue to encounter it in potential partners, friends, and colleagues. As you heal and collide with these patterns again, it can reactivate the fallout of past narcissistic abuse. The key to healing is to grow and flex the psychological muscle that helps you recognize these toxic people and patterns as they come up, and instead of trying to change them, to manage them. Here's how to listen to your instincts and establish protective boundaries. Lean into solitude. Finding solace in solitude is a big part of healing from narcissistic abuse and becoming narcissist resistant. Before all of you extroverts out there push back, let's break this down. Often, the reason narcissistic people have power is that many of us are afraid to be alone. The self-blame and confusion created by narcissistic abuse can make being alone very difficult. But solitude is a critical healing space. It isn't about isolation. It's about holding space for yourself and scaling back your tendencies toward excessive caregiving, one-sided compromise, and personal censorship for a minute. Solitude is where we find our voice. I once worked with a woman who was white-knuckling it through periods of solitude after a 40-year marriage to a narcissistic man. She learned to reflect on how she didn't feel on edge anymore, or let down because once again he hadn't come home and the dinner she painstakingly made had gone to waste. Instead, she reflected on the healing that came from being able to laugh out loud at a TV show she wanted to watch without feeling judged. Solitude was where she finally, at age 65, learned who she was and what she liked because she wasn't putting another person's needs first. To become narcissist resistant, it is important to reclaim the parts of yourself that you lost to your relationship. Some of that is becoming so comfortable with solitude that you are more discerning about whom you spend your time with. After years of having your identity shaped by a narcissistic person, this can be terrifying. But when solitude becomes a meaningful alternative, toxic people lose ground in your life. Aim for good enough. Perfectionism is a defense and coping strategy for most survivors of narcissistic abuse, who hold the eternal hope that if you could get yourself or the relationship just right, then everything would be better. It can also be a form of self-sabotage. I can't submit this work memo unless it is perfect. When you try to be perfect, you are still playing to the narcissistic person's grandiose obsession with perfection. Try for good enough. Instead, a place where you acknowledge that what you did is fine. The laundry may be done, but not ironed. The office may be a mess, but the bills got paid. The cupcakes can be store-bought. Striving for good enough is a key to healing. Once you radically accept and realize that you are no longer trying to do the impossible, getting it just right for someone else, you can pull back on this unhealthy standard. Practice mindfulness. When you're meeting new people, breathing and being present with yourself and in the moment allows you to be more discerning, to experience what is unfolding in front of you. The more present you can make yourself, the better you are at detecting unhealthy patterns and protecting yourself. Practicing mindfulness doesn't need to be fancy. Try a simple exercise where you identify the following, and keep a little snack around for the last step. 5 things you can see, 4 things you can hear, 3 things you can touch and feel, 2 things you can smell, keep a candle or scented oils nearby, and 1 thing you can taste. As you do this exercise, breathe deeply. Doing this once a day slows your mind down and can be especially useful if you're having a difficult interaction or are coming out of one. You can use this tool anytime you need to recalibrate your focus. Another mindfulness exercise that can ground you is describing a space you are in with tremendous detail. Pay attention to the light, the sounds, the smells, the objects, where they are, what they look like. This can be useful to do in real time, as well as if you are feeling uncomfortable in an interaction with a difficult person. And if you are stuck in a car with a raging narcissist, focus on the landscape outside the window. Let in joy. Remember joy? If you've been in a narcissistic relationship long enough, you may not. Narcissistic relationships are joy stealers. While you are in them, happiness, safety, and comfort are lacking, and you expend most of your psychological energy trying to avoid threats. Joy has to be on the narcissistic person's terms, and if they are having a bad day, so is everyone else. Allowing yourself to experience joy is a highly effective form of narcissist resistance and defiance, and it isn't about artificial positivity or listing what you are grateful for. For all the time you spent monitoring the narcissistic person's every mood and need, becoming narcissist resistant means training yourself to relish joy that comes your way, finding it in a small moment. A bright red sunset, a delicious ice cream cone, hummingbirds outside your window, and not having it stolen reminds you that life holds more beauty and hope than you thought. At first, you may experience joy guilt at the idea of doing something as forbidden as experiencing delight after a lifetime of being shamed for laughter or happiness. Then there is joy regret, where you realize how much you missed after so many years of trying to eke out safety and survival. Experiencing joy is an act of defiance if you've experienced narcissistic abuse. I liken it to letting in some light after you have been sleeping in the dark. You squint for a minute, but as time goes on, you become more practiced at seeking it out. Find these moments of wonderment, joy, and goodness, and allow them to envelop you. There's a book that accompanies this article if you're interested. It's Not You, Identifying and Healing from Narcissistic People. And it's by Ramani Durvasula. That's Durvasula, Ph.D. The book is $29 at PenguinR and Domhouse.com. We're still in the lifestyle section. This article is the three phrases parents should never say to their teens. Communicating with teenagers is a delicate business, experts Kara Natterson, MD, and Vanessa Kroll Bennett share some common pitfalls. This article is by Sophia Lodato. Navigating conversations with your teenagers can be tricky terrain, especially with puberty wreaking havoc on their developing brains. But while there's no tried and true guide to what to say to them during the hardest moments, there are a few conversation pitfalls worth avoiding. Parenting experts Kara Natterson, MD, and Vanessa Kroll Bennett, the authors of This Is So Awkward, Modern Puberty Explained, sat down with Oprah Daily to share what parents should never say to their teens. Calm down. As Kroll Bennett explains, no one in the history of the world has ever calmed down because someone told them to calm down. If your teen is already escalated, telling them to calm down will just make them escalate even further. So what should you do? Take a breath with a dose of empathy. You're not old enough to be in love. Crushes, intense relationships, new connections. It all happens in middle and high school. But having a parent shut down those feelings can be upsetting. Instead, as Natterson explains, parents should try to help their kids put words to the emotions they're feeling. How do they label it? Why are they calling it love? You're not fat, you're beautiful. As our experts share, there is a lot wrong and downright offensive about this statement. Let's face it, as kids' bodies are changing, they're going to have lots of moments of discomfort and low self-esteem. Natterson explains. In order to initiate a healthy discussion about body image, Natterson advised parents to explore what's underneath the feelings. Parts of this article were edited due to time. This article comes from the books section. Pain doesn't make us stronger. In Oprah's latest book club pick, Laura Love Harden wrote about finding love, purpose, and love after hardship. After the book was published, a shocking twist made her feel like she was living a lie. This article is by Laura Love Harden. I rang in the new year in silence. When the clock struck midnight on January 1st, 2024, I was in the passenger seat on my way to the San Francisco airport. My husband drove me there in strained silence, everything unsaid between us heavy in the heat that pumped through the car, while California rain pounded the windshield with a relentlessness that the wipers couldn't keep up with. He wasn't happy to have to drive me to San Francisco so late at night. I wasn't happy that he wasn't happy, that we weren't happy. I had tried on two separate occasions during the holidays to have the big, hard talk. We had grown apart. We were living separate lives. We were disconnected. He never spoke to me. Something had to change. I told him I had no interest in blowing up our lives, but I couldn't live in the silence. I couldn't stand feeling lonely and unloved in my own home with the one person on this planet who had vowed to love me forever. I couldn't imagine living this way for another day, much less another 30 years or more. "We have to talk about it," I pleaded. "We just have to communicate." The idea of pretending everything was okay when it wasn't just anathema to me. It was a dangerous gateway drug into the person I used to be. It felt good to say the unspoken things out loud. It felt good to articulate what I needed and wanted. Unfamiliar, but good. It felt like growth. It felt hopeful. Recently, at many book club appearances with groups of women around the country, we talked about deep, vulnerable, fearful things. Shame secrets. I had published an entire memoir about my own shame and secrets, addiction, crime, and incarceration. I had also written about my third time's a charm marriage to Sam. I had written a love story in the middle of a hard story, and now, after the book had just published, it felt like I was living a lie. But memoir, unlike autobiography, is a narrative around a fixed period of time. The memoir ends where it ends, but life continues. In those book clubs, we whispered excitedly about what it would be like, as women, as mothers, to ask for 100% of what we wanted and needed, 100% of the time. The idea that we could actually do that felt both revolutionary and rebellious. Asking doesn't mean you'll get it, of course, but not asking guarantees you won't. The truth was, I had changed profoundly in the 12 years since I started dating, and ultimately married my husband. And I will be the first to admit that I used to think emotionally unavailable men were sexy. Super sexy. But now I had changed. I needed and wanted more. I had been asking for it over and over again. I desperately wanted my husband to speak a language he had never spoken, and certainly one we had never spoken together. For him, I know it was like I had suddenly dropped him off in a foreign country and expected him to be fluent enough in the language to navigate his way home. The thing is, he didn't want to be in this new foreign land, and I couldn't pretend I was okay with living anywhere else. He dropped me at the airport and drove away in silence. "Have fun," he said half-heartedly. "Happy New Year," I said miserably. I had hours to wait before my flight, and as I sat alone in an uncomfortable plastic chair during the first few hours of 2024, I tried to focus on all the positive things in my life, on what I was most grateful for. Gratitude is always the best cure for a downward spiral. My four boys were doing great. My book was having an end-of-year resurgence on best-of lists. And my inbox and DMs were full of messages from readers who found hope in the pages of my memoir of a messy life. I was off on a work trip to Key West, Florida, where there would be sunshine and warm waters and great conversation with brilliant people I admired. I slept most of the flight, and when I walked off the plane and across the tarmac, I remember taking a deep breath of the warm air and feeling like somehow it was all going to be okay. 5 minutes later, while waiting for my suitcase and baggage claim, I got a call from my sister telling me that my father had died. It was sudden and shocking, and I was alone in an unfamiliar city in a state I had never been to. I didn't know what to do. I sat down and cried, openly and publicly, while worried airport security guards kept their distance. I don't remember the Uber ride to my hotel, but when the front desk checked me in, I remember asking the clerk if she could give me a hug. In my hotel room, my mind went to regret and self-incrimination. Why hadn't I picked up my dad's last call? Why had I settled for holiday group texts? Why hadn't I gone there at Thanksgiving like I always did? But then I did something different than how I had for always done things. I called a friend and said I didn't know what to do or where to go. I called my oldest son and asked him to call the rest of the family because I wasn't in a place to handle it. Then I called another friend, and then another. I vented, and I cried, and I let them step in to help me. They told me what to do next in the hours and days that followed. I didn't call my husband. He got word of what had happened that night and sent me a text. "I'm sorry about your dad." When I flew home a week later, my husband told me he had a date. 24 hours later, he told me he had manifested his dream woman. It took me a minute to understand what he was saying. He was in love with someone else, sleeping with someone else, while I was in grief and reeling, while he was still sleeping next to me. It was messy, and I raged because in my fantasy of our end, we both knew what was happening. I had imagined us communicating and being respectful and figuring out how to consciously uncouple and sort out our lives from a place of love. I was hurt and angry. In my mind, whatever was next for both of us was a long ways away, and we'd both get there through healing conversations and a gentle letting go process. There would be closure and an honoring of all we had built together. This was not that. This felt like being ejected from a rocket ship with no parachute. But that's the problem when you don't communicate. What I needed for an ending wasn't a new beginning, but for my husband it was. A part of me knew that his new love interest actually had nothing to do with me, but there was a part of me that was a little girl again, abandoned and alone. The velocity of change in the first few weeks of 2024 was unlike any other time in my life, and I wasn't a stranger to change or to life falling apart. But as the days of grief and loss and anger and regret unfolded, there was something else bigger at play. I had gone through death and divorce and major upheaval before, but I had always internalized the grief and the failures. I had always packed all of the pain of loss deep down inside me and told myself this only made me stronger, pretending to the outside world that I was perfectly fine when I wasn't used to be my default mode. I always smiled and insisted it was just a little warm when the house was actually burning down around me. But not this time. This time I had a community of deep relationships, true friendships, and people who loved me no matter what. My people were happy to be there when I needed them. When I was at my messiest, this time I let all the hard feelings move through me instead of stuffing them down into the dark where they could fester. I didn't worry about what the imperfection of my life might look like to people I worked with, to strangers, to readers, to my friends, or to my children. This time I asked for help when I was lost and in need of direction, and I let my community tell me what to do. Sleep, eat, talk, feel, rest, repeat. Things most people learn in childhood, but the opposite of what I learned growing up. And for the first time in my life, I was messy and human and angry and not always my best self, and I was still loved just the same by all the people who mattered most. I have enough perspective and life experience to know that falling apart is always the precursor to falling together. I wrote a whole book about falling apart and starting over. But 2024 has also made me appreciate the simple truth that you only really know what your coping skills are or how much you have truly changed when you are put to the test. Not once did I think about doing drugs again. Not once did I worry what people would think. Not once did I feel like my emotional life and needs would be a burden to my friends and family. Yes, I had gone through hard times before, but this time I was not alone. I was never alone. And as my life rearranges itself into the new normal it will be, I know that there is always a bigger message in the mess. Faith can be a tricky concept for people, but for me, it is simply the unwavering belief that everything that happens to me actually happens for me. I have lived enough lives to know this is true. I have failed at countless things to know that each time it is a pruning of my soul so that new growth can bloom. I have known death and loss and grief many times over, but this is the first time I have known what it is like to be held tenderly in community when you are fragile and breaking, and understood that pain doesn't make us stronger. People do. This article, "The Reason I Lost My Mind 1 Week a Month," comes from the wellness section. PMDD can make women feel depressed, rageful, or even suicidal. One woman breaks the silence around this disorder and shares how she got treatment. This article is by Shalene Gupta. Shortly after I was diagnosed with premenstrual dysphoric disorder, PMDD, I was talking to a close friend who has depression. "Have you ever had a serious mental health issue?" she asked. I told her that I'd just found out I had PMDD, a condition I'd previously never heard of. "I don't know what that is," my friend said. "Think severe PMS," I said. I could tell my explanation wasn't landing, so I gave her a short description. Having PMDD means that for a few days a month, right before my period, I morph from a quiet, conflict-averse introvert to an implacable storm of anxiety, depression, and rage. I scream, I throw things. Occasionally, I'll attempt suicide, trying to swallow too many pills before spitting them out at the last minute. Then, just as suddenly as the storm appears, it vanishes, only to come back next month. For years, I assumed I was a bad person with poor emotional control. "I wouldn't say it's serious," I said, "not compared to what you've gone through." "Honey," my friend said, "I've never been suicidal. I can't believe you deal with this every month." Then she demanded, "How have I never heard of this before?" It was the same question I was asked when I was diagnosed, because people don't talk about PMDD. We don't understand that a small minority of people can experience severe psychiatric symptoms before their period. People with PMDD are not getting the help they need, so they suffer in silence and shame, hiding their symptoms instead of talking about them. And so the silence grows deeper, trapping people with PMDD in a vicious cycle. Here are the basics. For a PMDD diagnosis, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the handbook that mental health professionals use to make a diagnosis, requires experiencing at least one symptom from this list. Increased mood swings, anger / irritability, depression, anxiety, and at least one symptom from this list for a total of at least 5 symptoms. Decreased interest in activities, difficulty concentrating, lethargy, marked change in appetite, marked change in sleeping patterns, sense of being overwhelmed, physical symptoms such as breast tenderness, joint or muscle pain, bloating, or weight gain. These symptoms must be severe enough to cause distress or interfere with someone's work, education, or relationships. The symptoms must also appear the week before menstruation and then disappear the week after it finishes. Studies estimate that 3 to 8% of menstruators meet the criteria for PMDD. Psychiatry professor C. Neil Epperson at the University of Colorado, who specializes in women's reproductive and behavioral health, played a key role in making PMDD an official diagnosis. She considers it a miracle that more people don't have premenstrual mood disorders, given the vast impact hormones have on how our brains function. Our brains are constantly changing to be able to adjust to hormone fluctuations, she says. Progesterone gets broken down into a steroid that acts like a barbiturate. A woman's brain has to change to accommodate that. Otherwise, she'll be sedated during her entire luteal phase. PMDD treatments are fairly straightforward on paper. According to Ruta Nonacs, that's N-O-N-A-C-S, a psychiatrist who treats PMDD at the Massachusetts General Hospital Center for Women's Mental Health. The disorder is relatively easy to treat for most people. I would say there's about 10% that's very hard to treat, but a lot of people respond beautifully to medication, she says. Once someone has been diagnosed, first-line options for treatment are birth control, SSRIs, or a combination of both. Studies have found that SSRIs can be used intermittently only during the luteal phase, i.e. the second phase of your cycle ending with the first day of your period, to treat PMDD. When I called my primary care provider after learning about PMDD through Google, I was terrified she would tell me I was managing my symptoms. Thankfully, she was compassionate. "I can't believe you've been living like this for over a decade," she said. "We're going to get you help immediately." With that, she had my undying devotion. I had visions of a new, magical me who practiced Zen Buddhism and was full of compassion. However, I was wary of antidepressants. I'd heard horror stories about getting addicted and gaining weight. My doctor also said she didn't much like prescribing antidepressants, so she put me on Nikki, the generic version of Yaz, the only birth control the FDA has approved to treat PMDD. The main effect, not getting a period, was life-changing. Instead of spending a week on the couch curled up in pain, I could run, I could focus on work, and I didn't feel sleepy or sluggish. I was so happy that I didn't have a period that it took me nearly 4 months to realize that my mood swings were getting worse. I thought my anger would go away entirely on birth control. It didn't. Instead, it blazed in the back of my mind, often pushing itself forward until it consumed my thoughts. Almost every day seemed to be a PMDD day. A few months after going on Yaz, my boyfriend, Ashir, and I went on a road trip to the Berkshires. He'd booked a tour of Edith Wharton's house, and I was deeply excited. But that morning, I woke up with a storm brewing in my head. And as we drove down the highway lined with orange trees, the storm grew worse. All I could think about was a fight we'd had a couple of months previously when I'd felt jealous about one of his ex-girlfriends and had pushed him to admit he thought she was prettier than me. That day, she loomed large in my imagination. I wondered if prettier was code for saner or a better partner. I wanted to take a razor to my face and cut away my imperfections so I could leave my cheeks, my nose, and my extra pounds littered on the highway. None of this came out cleanly. Instead, I alternated between sobbing and yelling, "Why would you say those things to me?" Nothing Ashir said could calm me down. Instead, his assurances made me spin like a top. I didn't want to live anymore because I didn't deserve to. Then I popped open the car door and tried to jump out onto the highway. Ashir grabbed my seatbelt and slammed the door shut. Then he pulled over to the side of the road. We sat staring at each other, him clutching the steering wheel, gulping air, too stunned to cry. The rest of the day was blurry, but two things became very clear to me. First, I did not want to die. Second, I needed to call my doctor. Yaz wasn't working. My doctor referred me to a gynecologist who put me on Sisonik, an extended birth control that meant I'd have a period once every 3 months. On Sisonik, I entered the state of Zen calm I'd been dreaming about. I didn't have cramps or mood swings. There was just a beautiful silence in my head. PMDD felt like a bad dream. Gradually, I began to forget what it felt like. But Sisonik also had side effects. First, it killed my libido. Second, it made me ravenous. Within 3 months, I put on 10 pounds. I wanted to spend the rest of my life as a Zen Buddhist monk at an all-you-can-eat buffet. Choosing between my sanity and my sexuality didn't seem like a winning situation. When I went to my gynecologist and asked for a different treatment, she didn't have another birth control recommendation. She prescribed fluoxetine, an SSRI. I was still wary of antidepressants, so I asked to take the minimum dose possible, meaning a few days before my period or just during my luteal phase. Fluoxetine worked, but not as beautifully as Sisonik. I felt like putting a leash on my emotions. I still felt them, but now they didn't control me. I could still go about my day, even if anger, depression, and anxiety howled by the sidelines. Fluoxetine dampened my sex drive slightly, but did not completely obliterate it, and it gave me the occasional headache, but the trade-off felt worth it. It's given me my life back, and I see this play out month after month. For years, I imagined I was alone in my monthly PMDD spirals. I spent many nights wandering through my neighborhood because staying home meant a screaming battle with my boyfriend. I'd wonder where to go next and what I should do when I got cold or tired. As I walked past lit windows and families settling down into their bedtime routines, I felt terribly alone. But now, I realized that during all those years, I had never walked alone. I'd always been part of a family. Perhaps we did not know each other by name, but in spirit, we lived the same lives. Month after month, we battled our minds to stay alive in the hope that another, better day would come. For a few of us, the next day did not come. For some of us, better came and stayed. But for many, better would come only to vanish once again with the turning of our cycles. And there is a book that accompanies this article. It's called The Cycle by Shailene Gupta. It's called Confronting the Pain and Periods and PMDD. And you can find it at Bookshop for $25 if you're interested. So we're heading over to some of Oprah's favorite things. Here's a Stone Hollow Farmstead Blissful Breakfast Gift Box. It's $111 at Amazon. God is in the details, and these people understand details. An exquisite breakfast, pancake mix, syrup, infused jellies, and more, arrives in a birch box decorated with dried flowers. It's also available at StoneHollowFarmstead.com. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.